everyone, it's Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Welcome back. How you doing, Jordan?
Good, good. How about you?
Pretty good. Nothing much happening since the last time we spoke, so.
Yeah, probably same, yeah.
Pretty uneventful. Super,
yeah.
We're just two working gals.
Yes, yep.
Yeah, so the last episode was really great. I had a lot of fun. And I learned a lot about Elena Damiani. I got very excited. I texted you last night because mm-hmm. she liked our posts and shared them on her social media. So it was very yes. nice to see that.
Yeah, that was truly exhilarating. I was like, wow. Mm-hmm.
I know. And the Instagram account of the artist I'll be talking about today already liked our post from today.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So... thanks to the artists / their representatives on social media
yes.
for finding us and supporting us.
Yes.
Okay, so today's episode is going to be on Huguette Calland. She is a Lebanese painter, sculptor, and fashion designer best known for her erotic abstract paintings and body landscapes. So I have not known... about her for long. I've only known her for the few weeks since, you know, I announced that I'd be talking about her in this upcoming episode. And I actually had a little bit of a hard time doing research on her because,
oh, really?
Yeah, because so I went into it initially excited and then I struggled a little because of her father's history. So her father was Bashar al-Khoury. He was the first post-independence president of Lebanon from September 1943 till 1952, when he was basically forced into resignation.
Oh.
He had previously served two brief terms as prime minister when we were still under the French mandate. So he served from 1927 to 1928 and May through October of 1929. So I didn't know that much about him. I knew, obviously, that, you know, he was our first post-independence president. Mm-hmm. I actually, as I was doing research on her, I brought her up to my dad, who's a very big history buff. And when I mentioned who her dad was, he kind of just scoffed.
Oh?
Because, yeah, he has, so the president has a very rough history. And I actually found this New York Times article from 1964, when he passed. And I did want to read it in this episode because I feel like on top of the art, it is important to acknowledge this kind of history. And, you know, I don't want to make him the center of this episode because she is not her father. Mm-hmm. And she spent most of her career trying to break away from that. But to people who aren't from Lebanon and are listening to our podcast and are curious, this article gives a brief history. So... I don't know, Jordan, if you've heard of him at all.
No, I have not. Yeah.
Okay, so I will... There you go. Okay, so I will read this article a little bit. And it's actually really interesting just to see how Western media portrays him. And I would like to hope that journalism has changed a little bit since then because... Hang on, listen to this. So this is the headline. Bashar al-Khoury dies at 73, former president of Lebanon. Bashar al-Khoury, Lebanon's first president after it gained independence in 1943, died here tonight at the age of 73. Subtitle is Jailed After Election. Bashar al-Khoury was a stocky, bald man with striking blue eyes. Yeah, I don't understand what the... is journalistic a word?
Yeah.
I'm going to use it. The journalistic choice was for this.
Yeah.
But... anyway, so that's how it starts. And then it says, he helped push first the Turks and then the French out of his country and was generally regarded by his people as a good leader until he allowed his family and his friends to turn the country into a private preserve for their financial deals.
Oh.
And actually, when I read this segment to my dad, he's like, he just kind of laughed and he's like, oh, he wasn't doing that from the beginning. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh.
So he was elected in 1943 as the first president of an independent Lebanon and was jailed soon afterward, along with most of his cabinet, for trying to amend the constitution to eliminate French privileges in Lebanon. At that time, there were still French troops in the country. 11 days after his arrest, he was freed, but only after the British had put pressure on the French. He finally won his fight and succeeded in getting all foreign troops out of the country by the end of 1946. In 1949, Parliament amended the constitution to allow President El-Khoury to be elected for a second term. By 1952, however, strong feeling was growing among the people against his government. His administration was charged with nepotism and corruption. His son's law practice and business operations, it was said, were showing unusually large profits. Other members of his family were making deals and providing jobs for friends. Action was questioned. In 1950, a deputy in the chamber cast the first stone. He wanted to know why Mrs. El-Khoury had taken $100,000 worth of gold to Paris with her.
Oh.
The government, I know, the government replied that she had already spent the money in the interests of the Lebanese Republic and has been doing the job of an ambassador.
Okay.
Sure. So at that point, a general anti-government movement developed in which Camille Chamoun, who was actually became president right after El-Khoury, was one of the leaders of this movement. On September 18, 1952, Mr. El-Khoury yielded to opposition pressure and gave up the presidency. His action followed a three-day general strike in Beirut. The stoppage had called by the opposition to highlight demands for a cleanup in the government. He made a final effort to save his government, approving a sweeping program of reforms, including distribution of state land among the peasants, to quote, revision of the judicial system, and dismissal of unnecessary government employees. That's Bashar al-Khoury. Yeah. I actually kind of went into a deep dive on the internet and found more and more information on him and kind of was very tempted to put all of that in there. But again, I don't want to make this all about him.
Yeah.
I just wanted to kind of address it because, yeah, he was not the best. And his intentions were not always pure.
Yeah.
But this basically is a brief history because it's also, you know, Calan was his only daughter. I'm unsure of the accuracy of this article in its entirety because it mentions his son, even though some other websites only show her as his only child.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure he had a son.
Okay.
So, she was his only daughter. That's what I'm confident in. And if I'm wrong, sorry. But, so, she said it herself, to become an artist was, for her, was the toughest thing to do in Lebanon. You know, the history of the Middle East was made, it was shaped even, as she was growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, we gained independence while she was a toddler. So, growing up in a very political climate has an impact on her. And she, in one interview, recalls one birthday when she was younger. Seven kids did not show up. And their parents never reached out to explain why. Those parents were French. So they did not take their kids to the birthday or let, you know, her mom know in protest of Bashar al-Khoury and the emancipation of Lebanon.
Wow.
They were pro-French mandate. Yeah. So that was her birthday.
Oh my God.
As a kid, exactly.
7-year-old birthday is a political statement.
I know. It's crazy. And, you know, in some interviews, she kind of, she doesn't really celebrate him, but she doesn't critique him either. So I do want to make note of that. And that's one of the reasons why I was very hesitant. But, you know, she's, if there's anything I've learned about her in my research is that she prioritizes herself and her love of art and just her love of life more than anything else or anyone else. And that'll be very clear as I continue to talk about her. But yeah, so like in one interview she says, Lebanon was fighting for its independence, but I was fighting for mine. She says, I never stopped loving my parents, but I wanted to be my own self ever since I was 13 years old. So yeah, one example of this. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's probably a lot of pressure to come from that kind of family and to feel like you don't want to be defined by the actions of your family or your parents.
Exactly.
To carve out your own path.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a huge part of who she is and a huge part of her identity is wanting to create something and make something of herself. So one of the earliest examples of that is Paul Calon, her husband.
Mm-hmm.
She met him when she was 12 years old. He was 17. And she claims that she instantly knew that he would be the man she would spend her life with.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Wow.
But here's the issue. His family is pro-French mandate and one of Shahr al-Khoury's biggest political rivals.
Okay. Wow.
Uh-huh. So, of course, her parents were very much against this.
Yeah.
And, you know, she recalls it took years of constant arguments, many shed tears in the house before their eventual approval. She married him in 1952 when she was 21 years old, which was the same year as her father's resignation. Hmm. So, you know, I'm sure that that was not necessarily a coincidence, I don't think. So,
yeah.
But then makes sense as I continued to research her and, you know, you'll know more about this as I continue to talk about her. After getting married, they both took lovers.
Oh.
Even though she was convinced from the age of 12 that this is it, this is the man. But I know. So her lover was George Apostu, a Romanian sculptor.
Okay.
And it's just a reflection of really her life's philosophy of living life without restrictions. So much so to the point where she didn't want a conventional marriage. And, you know, mm-hmm. he also took a lover. So it was not one-sided.
Yeah.
She spent most of her early adulthood taking care of her father. So aside from Paul and her dad, she didn't really do much for herself. She did not take painting seriously until after her father's death in 1964.
Oh, okay.
So after his passing, she enrolled at the American University of Beirut in her early 30s and majored in fine arts, graduated with her degree in 1968. So in pre-war Beirut, she moved in cosmopolitan kind of artistic circles and just became the symbol of women's emancipation in the Arab world. But it was Paris that truly liberated her, and it showed in her subsequent work. She left Lebanon for Paris in 1970 to flex her artistic muscles because she believed that although she could make art anywhere, she wanted a career, right? So she says that, "I thought I was strong enough to confront the world with my work. I thought I had wings to fly." And you know, she left behind her husband and her three teenage children in Lebanon to go to Paris.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And one of her children, her daughter Brigitte, says this about her mother's move to Paris. "The lines of her drawings became thinner, more sophisticated. It was a different moment in her life. The colors changed. She did a lot of erotic works she would not have done in Lebanon. It freed her being in Paris." So, yeah, it was a pivotal moment for her. And, you know, she left her whole family behind. And on the topic of making something of herself because it felt so impossible in Lebanon, she says this: "I wanted to have my own identity. In Lebanon, I was the daughter of, wife of, mother of, sister of. It was such a freedom to wake up all by myself in Paris. I needed to stretch." So, yeah. She just wanted out of all of it, of all this conventional, these conventional expectations of her as, you know, the daughter of the first president, the wife of this French man who was a political rival of her father's,
mm-hmm.
a mother of three children, a sister of, oh, there you go, that confirms it. She does, she does have a sibling, so a sister of, you know, so she wanted to run away from all of that. She was tired of all of it. Again, she wanted to live a life without any restrictions.
Do you know how long she was in Paris for?
She was in Paris for a very long time. I think about 30 years, 20 or 30 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she was there for a very long time.
Did her family ever move to be with her?
Oh. No. Yeah.
Wow.
And actually, I was reading an article about this, and her daughter is quoted in quite a bit of it, of, you know, like, growing up without a mother, basically. It's very interesting, the approach that the daughter takes. I didn't quote her word for word in my notes, but she kind of says, you know, you see your parents become individual people with individual lives, and once you grow older and you see who they are and what they've become, you kind of understand.
Mm.
Which was an interesting kind of perspective on it. I don't think a lot of children would feel that way if they were abandoned by a parent.
No.
But again, I didn't find enough information about what the circumstances were of that distance between them. Did she visit at all? Did they visit her, you know? And eventually she did go, after that period of time in Paris, she did eventually go to Los Angeles to be closer to her children. So,
oh, okay.
That was much later in life, you know?
Yeah. That's so interesting, though.
Yeah. It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
But again, a life without restrictions, that's what she wanted.
Yeah.
And that's what she got. And obviously, with most of her work, which was kind of explicitly erotic, she could not exhibit that in Lebanon.
Mm.
But even in Paris, it wasn't immediately accepted, you know, because she had to make a name for herself.
Right.
And it wasn't until her late career that she first began winning recognition in the West. Hmm. So, you know, her first solo show was mounted in 2019 at the Tate, St. Eve's in the UK. She passed away in 2019.
Oh, wow.
Her first U.S. solo show is coming up this year.
Oh, in New York. God.
This is the first one ever. Yeah.
Wow.
And she's gone. She can't see it.
Yeah, she... Oh. That's sad. That's so sad.
I know, but it's, I'm not surprised, you know, the same thing happened with Shuker, you know?
Yeah.
I feel wrong saying it like that, Sher. The Arab in me is like, no, pronounce it properly. Sorry. But yeah, same thing happened, so I'm not at all surprised about that. You know, they were such pioneering women in the modern era, but it wasn't until their late careers, when they couldn't really enjoy the, I guess, fruits of their labor as much, that they got the attention.
Yeah.
So that solo show that's coming up, it's called Huguette Calan Tête à Tête. It's going to be the artist's most comprehensive solo museum exhibition. It has works on paper and canvas that span across 5 decades of her career.
Wow.
Including caftans, which she was... They were basically... her staple wardrobe were those caftans, mannequins, sculptures, and notebooks. And to quote the Drawing Center in New York, where the show will be up, it will show her candidness and mutability of drawing to challenge taboos associated with the representation of female sexuality.
Hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, throughout her career, she remained captivated by the female form, including her own. She was constantly challenging these conventional notions of beauty and desire, and this was especially the case because she struggled to accept her own physical shape, often wearing long flowing caftans, which she also used as painter smocks. And, you know, I've seen quite a few interviews of her. She's very quirky. it's interesting to follow. But, you know, she says, yeah, I was fat. I was 5'2" and 200 pounds at my heaviest, and I just hated these expectations that people placed on me, and I wore these caftans, right? Even her husband, apparently, preferred her in haute couture, but she vehemently rejected fashions that were designed for tall, slim figures, especially after having kids.
Yeah.
And... You know, in this New York Times article that was written after her passing, it says her desire was to live without restrictions, whether at the dinner table, at the easel, or in bed.
Okay.
Yeah, to hint at, you know, her lover as well. So, and it's true. That's exactly how she lived. But I think that the caftans and this idea of body image are very interesting. And, you know, what started as wardrobe became also a very notable project that she mm-hmm. worked on when she was in Paris. It was in collaboration with Pierre Cardin. He was an Italian-born French designer, best known for his avant-garde style, space-age designs, and geometric shapes and motifs. He often ignored the female form, which obviously she would appreciate since she hated all haute couture that was designed for a certain body shape.
Yeah.
And he even advanced into unisex fashions sometimes, but most of it was experimental and not always very practical. So anyway, one day in 1978, she walked into his boutique wearing one of her signature caftans, and he was hooked. He asked her to do a collection together.
Wow.
So she, I think in collaboration with him, they designed 100 of them.
And oh my God.
True to form, she designed some of them with breasts, a belly button, and pubic hair on the front. And, you know, the shape of a buttocks on the back. These will be posted on social media for people to see. But yeah, she had no shame. And it's actually really funny watching interviews of an 80-year-old woman talking about this so freely and so openly. I think it's very refreshing to see, especially as someone who's Lebanese. Like, she's a Lebanese woman, she's in her 80s, and she's just talking about all these sexual kind of articles of clothing that she created, and very mm-hmm. proudly so.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, and I just pulled the pictures up of
there you them. Go.
Those are so funny.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow. And even
they're so fun.
Yeah, even some of them are mannequins that she designed and she created.
Oh.
So some of those also have kind of these interesting like proportions and mm-hmm. almost sexual features to them.
Yeah.
So some of them would be on display just as mannequins, others would have the caftan on them.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that the caftans are a really interesting aspect of her work. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the big projects in Paris, but another big one, and one that she's most known for, is Bribes de Corps, which translates to body parts.
Mm.
It's her most famous work. It's a series of paintings that she began in the 1970s. They are these fleshy, curvaceous forms that resemble parts of the female anatomy. And The National, which is a publication in Abu Dhabi, described them as abstract and sensuous, like a celebration of the plumpness of life. So, an interesting quote,
mm-hmm.
but that is how they described it. And, you know, inspired by her own body and femininity, these large, exuberant, semi-abstract paintings kind of challenged this patriarchal society that dominated Lebanon. I've posted a few of them already on social media, and there will be a few more once this episode is up. But they're kind of mysterious in terms of form and color.
Yeah.
They're, you know, when I first looked at them, they weren't very overtly sexual to me. They're very open images. The composition is very subtle, but it does hint at kind of a sexual nature to them. There's a lot of charisma. It feels like very sophisticated, which mm-hmm. exemplifies how much Paris impacted her. So, you know, I think it's very interesting to look at. And I don't know, it's like, it's the last thing I would have expected of her. But what's interesting is that, and I kind of got annoyed at myself at this, because when I looked at these paintings, my mind went to Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yeah, I saw that a little as well.
Yeah. But we've had this conversation in a previous episode where, you know, people, men specifically, men critics in the 20th century labeled Georgia O'Keeffe's works as very, very sexual, when really that was not at all what she was trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to separate her from that. All I will say is that the forms and the lines, like from a very, I guess, formal point of view, are very similar between Calan and O'Keefe. So
yeah,
I think those are the similarities that you could draw, and it's understandable for your, you know, for your mind to go in that direction. Mm-hmm. I think
I saw, so like on the first image that mm-hmm. we posted, it almost like the one that's yellow and then there's like some pink around like the line, like that almost made me think of like something scientific, like mm-hmm. as if you were looking at like a cell, like a molecule, like it looked like you were looking at something under a microscope, which I thought,
I agree.
Yeah.
There's something very, there's something very calculated about them.
Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful, but also very, like, specific.
Right, exactly. And a lot of it, these proportions, you don't think slim, tall figures, right? You think fuller, more curvy. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what she was trying to do. And again, a lot of it was inspired by her own battles with her femininity and with her body. So that's reflected across everything. I mean, in all the oil paintings she did, any ink drawings, sculptures, textiles, it just became a constant theme. And some were representational figures, others were more abstract, like these are line drawings, you know, they're very voluptuous, they're very organic, mm-hmm. But almost always, across so many articles, they're described as most often decidedly feminist, which, you know, is true. And I think it's very safe to label her as a feminist because in my head, I was comparing her quite a bit to Scheer because they were working around the same time. I wonder if their paths ever crossed, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
You know, with Scheer, she never labeled herself as a feminist. And, you know, there weren't any records of her claiming that.
Mm-hmm.
But with Calan, there were quite a few interviews well into, like, 2010 or 2011 that she was doing where, you know, her work was labeled as such and she didn't disagree with it. And even if she didn't explicitly use the term because maybe she wasn't as familiar with it, or maybe she just chose not to say it in interviews.
Mm-hmm.
All the language that she used and all her beliefs and everything like that, it all aligned.
Yeah.
And was very clearly feminist. So that's what I think.
And I feel like, you know, a few weeks ago when I talked about Maya Deren and we were saying how, you know, a lot of people nowadays say that she was feminist, but she was working in a time before kind of that label really, like, even was a thing and could be recognized. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of, you know, questionable whether how much we can assign that to her. I feel like considering that Calan is not, she's not saying, I'm not this, I feel like it's a little more safe. Like, it makes more sense. Like, I wouldn't feel as bad.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe I didn't come across a certain interview or a certain article where she does explicitly say it. But, you know, I don't believe her daughter, in what I've read, denied it. I don't think she ever denied it. So, you know, I think that she is it's very safe to assume that she is. You know, with Scheer, I don't believe any scholarly articles that I read ever called her a feminist.
Mm.
At least those that I came across. Because it's a lot more difficult to make that assumption with her. But with Calan, or with maybe Maya Deren, you know, it's a lot safer to assume so.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of an overview of her. And, you know, like I said before, in her mid-50s, after the death of her lover, she moved to Los Angeles to be nearer to her children.
Right.
And, you know, what's funny is there was this one video where she was giving a tour of her home. And even her home fell into this philosophy she had of living life with no restrictions. So apart from the guest bathroom, none of the other rooms had doors.
Oh.
Not even her master bedroom, not even her master bathroom.
Oh, wow.
She claims doors make her claustrophobic.
Okay.
Yeah. So
sure.
She just did not believe in that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I know. And amusedly, oh my God, I don't know how to describe this in a PG way. The rods in her closet to hang her clothes.
Uh-huh.
So on either side of those, she painted figures that were very suggestive.
Oh.
Around the rod. Oh, in the mouth area. If that makes sense.
Oh my gosh. You follow. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so funny. So, this, like, 70-year-old woman or something. I know. Is she, like, 70 at this point?
70s or 80s.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So, she's just living her life.
Yeah.
Just no cares in the world. So, you know, I had to pause that. And when she got to that point, just maybe I'll share this. Again, you can find all of the interviews and articles that I'm talking about in our link tree, but maybe I'll post onto our story just that clip of her showing her closet and having the smuggest smile on her face. It's so good.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, she says, you know, life shouldn't be a punishment. It is for many people. I don't want it to be that way for me. And she says, I admit that I'm privileged, but I think that my character is my biggest privilege because I was born happy. And it kind of shows. I mean, you see this woman walking around her house with no doors, with a explicitly sexual closet.
Yeah.
Just, why not, you know? And it's very interesting because in those interviews that I watched, I did not see Bribe de Corps or, you know, any of those sexual caftans. I really only saw what she was producing during that time and, you know, her later work of the 2000s. And she actually had assistants in her studio doing a lot of the grunt work because, you know, when she passed away, her daughter did confirm that she experienced a lot of neurological problems since a fall in 2006. And because of this fall, she lost her ability to paint in 2013.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So her later works are very, very much oriented towards textile work, to rugs, and kind of this. There is, some of them are still sensual, but it was very different from what I was seeing from her work in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah.
And in talking about that, you know, she says that growing up, her mom filled their house with rugs. And which I kind of had a similar experience growing up. And Persian rugs were very popular in Lebanon as well because they're all, you know, hand-sewn and very delicate and intricate. So her mom filled their house with them, but she never associated that with her work. But in reality, however, as she looked at her later work, it was all about rugs because she was kind of taking this approach of textiles and, I guess, a more rustic perspective in the art rather than overtly sexual.
And it's interesting how, like, something from her childhood, which she probably wasn't thinking about, kind of came back
just
in her,
unconsciously
her later years.
Affected her. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's what I saw of her in the 2000s.
Okay.
And again, she lost her ability to paint in 2013. What's interesting is that, you know, despite the affairs and practically living two different lives from a distance, Calan and her husband did remain close and they never divorced.
Wow.
Yeah. So when he got sick, she moved back to Beirut to be with him in 2013. And she stayed there until her own passing in 2019.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting to me because when I think about it, it's like, okay, he got sick in 2013. She also lost her ability to paint in 2013. So, you know, how much of it was going there because he was sick? And how much of it was, well, I can't paint anymore anyway, so I might as well be with him.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But again, she really did care for him, so I'm sure that was a huge factor. But
yeah, of course.
I think not being able to have the choice of painting definitely helped in her move. back mm-hmm. to Beirut, because at that point she'd been gone since 1970. So
3 or 4 decades.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, to move back to be with him and then staying there afterwards. But it's interesting. And that is the life of Huguette Calon.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
She's fascinating. I'm glad
very
that,
much.
Yeah, I'm glad that you chose to talk about her today.
Yeah, I'm glad too. I'm glad I overcame that initial kind of hesitation.
Yeah, which I mean, I don't blame you.
Yeah.
But it seems like she succeeded in creating her own right. identity in life.
Yeah, I mean, apart from finding out initially about her father, the more I read about her work or the more I saw of her, you know, he was the furthest thing from my mind.
Yeah.
Didn't even consider him at all in anything that she was talking about or creating. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah,
then it is it.
Yeah. Thank you, Maria.
Thanks for listening. Yeah, so that's it on my part. And again, all the images on our Instagram, on our Twitter, you can find all the sources in our link tree. And Jordan, would you like to share who you will be talking about next?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about the artist Agnes Dennis. Okay. She is a land artist. She was one of the few, well, that's not entirely accurate, I guess, but she was one of the female land artists who is often recognized or talked about alongside kind of the canonical male land artists.
Okay.
Her biggest piece, or the one that she's probably most well known for and associated with, is it was like a installation, doesn't even feel like the right word, but basically in New York City, she planted a whole field of wheat, like in the middle of Manhattan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's a little taste. I will
mean, why not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will obviously talk more about that project and some of the other stuff that she's done, because she has a lot of other cool, like, land and environmental related pieces, as well as some other stuff too that's really fun. So
amazing. Well, yeah. I'm very excited to hear about that.
Yeah. It should be
left
fun.
Left me hanging on a field of wheat.
I know. Yeah.
It's fine. We'll wait. We'll be patient. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.